Healthcare is one of the central issues of the presidential campaign this year. We'll compare proposals from former Vice President Biden and from President Trump and talk about what they could mean for the insurance marketplace. Now, it's the second day of confirmation hearings for President Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. Unlike yesterday, Coney Barrett faced rounds of questions from both sides of the aisle. The committee is made up of 12 Republicans and 12 Democrats, all but guaranteeing she'll make it to a full vote in the Senate. Coney Barrett would be a big shift from the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and could move the court in a more conservative direction on high-profile issues. On day two of the hearings, Amy Coney Barrett talked about how the nomination and confirmation process has impacted her so far.
I've made distinct choices. I've decided to pursue a career and have a large family. I have a multiracial family. Our faith is important to us. All of those things are true, but they are my choices. And in my personal interactions with people, I mean, I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them. And the same is true professionally. I mean, I apply the law, and Senator, I think I should say why I'm sitting in this seat in response to that question, too, why I've agreed to be here, because I don't think it's any secret to any of you or to the American people that this is a really difficult, some might say excruciating, process.
Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Amy Coney Barrett and the confirmation process so far? What do you think about the move by President Trump to push for the confirmation process in this election year, the election month in effect? Do you support the move to confirm, or should the Senate wait? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Eric T. Casper is professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we have this nominee in front of 12 Republicans, 10 Democrats in the Senate. What are your takeaways from what you've seen so far?
Well, of course, as you mentioned earlier, today is the first day of questioning for the nominee, and so it really gives an opportunity for us to learn a little bit more about what the nominee thinks and what their general constitutional philosophy is, for instance, and a number of questions from senators on kind of major constitutional issues like equal protection of the law, abortion, gun rights, the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, Citizens United. A lot of questions and a lot of statements from senators along those lines today, certainly.
Can you talk about how big an impact this justice could have, or this judge could have, if confirmed as a justice?
Well, the nomination of one person to the Supreme Court, of course, we have to keep in mind it's a court of nine. And so the change of one person isn't going to mean a complete shift in terms of how they might approach these questions, how the court might approach these questions. But because of the fact that based on ideology, Justice Ginsburg is one of the justices on the current court who was much more so on the liberal end of the court. And based on the expected ideology of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, based on rulings that she has issued and decisions and opinions on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the expectation is that she would be farther to the right in terms of those measures of ideology on the Supreme Court. And so what might have been a 5-4 decision one way with Justice Ginsburg in the majority could be a 5-4 decision the other way. But of course, not only is it the case that each of these justices only moves the court a certain extent, because again, it is a court of nine, but the justices themselves will tell you, and the nominee in front of the Senate will typically tell you that they don't think of it in terms of ideology. They think of it in terms of approaching the law and answering these legal questions. And so the way that we might think about it in terms of the popular culture take on it, or the way the media reports it, is not necessarily the way that these individual judges and justices will tend to think of what their job is.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is the Judiciary Committee chair in the Senate. He questioned Coney Barrett about a number of issues, including how cases make it to the Supreme Court. And he brought up the District of Columbia versus Heller, a Second Amendment case. Here's a bit of their conversation about how Coney Barrett would tackle some of those cases.
It would start because there was a law, then there was a lawsuit, then there was an appeal, then the court granted cert, and then the court decided the case.
Is that true no matter what the issue is, whether it's gun, abortion, health care, campaign finance? Does that process hold true for everything?
Yes. You always know, judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
That said, those kind of cases do wind their way through to make it out into the Supreme Court ultimately. Can you talk about that that thought on how this all works, Eric?
Sure. And of course, Judge Amy Coney Barrett is correct that the Supreme Court of the United States, like other courts that we have in our system, they have to wait for cases and controversies to come to them. I talk to my students about this, that, you know, courts don't go out there and decide one morning, hey, I want to decide this issue, right? I mean, they're not legislators. They don't, a legislator can just introduce a bill on any topic that interests the legislator, on the topic that they think is the most pressing, but a judge has to wait for a case to come to them. Now, as you point out, though, I mean, these types of cases on these types of issues, whether it was what was being referenced in that exchange between Senator Graham and Judge Barrett, as far as the Second Amendment, you know, those types of cases certainly do come to the court. And you have to keep in mind that the Supreme Court, the way that it's structured, almost all of its docket is discretionary. In other words, most court, if you think about the trial level court, a case gets filed in front of a trial level court, and it would typically be the case that they would have to hear that case. They don't have a choice. But the U.S. Supreme Court has a large amount of its docket that is discretionary. So there are several thousand cases that are appealed to the court every year, yet they only give full review to currently about 70 cases per year. And so it's only about one that they give full review to, meaning that there are choices the justices can make as far as which types of cases they want to hear. They have criteria that are set up in terms of federal law that they should be considering as far as the types of cases to take for full review. But ultimately, these, as you mentioned, these types of cases do work their way to the court. And if they don't get to choose that they want to decide a case on a particular constitutional issue today, if they're on the court long enough with a lifetime appointment, chances are that those opportunities will eventually arise.
We're talking to Eric Casper, professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at UW-Eau Claire, with us to talk about the latest on the Amy Coney Barrett hearing in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you listening or watching? What do you think so far? Do you think this is the time to move on this confirmation process? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Amy Coney Barrett and her path to the Supreme Court. Our guest is Eric T. Casper, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the nomination, the process, the timing, and what you've heard or seen so far in the hearings. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to a caller now. Linda is with us in West Bend. Linda, hi.
Hi. I do believe they should be going ahead with the process for three reasons. First of all, the president is president all the way through almost the end of January. It's not like other countries where as soon as the election is done, power is turned over. Secondly, they haven't brought forward a super controversial candidate. I think they've had proof that people from both sides agree with her, that she is full of integrity and will uphold the law. And thirdly, I think it's hypocrisy if the Democrats are going to suggest that if the situation was reversed, where there was a Democratic president and a Democratic majority in the Senate, we all know that they would do the same thing. So that's why I think they should be going ahead with the nomination.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Democrats complaining about the precedent set in the Merrick Garland nomination when President Obama was president and when Republicans controlled the Senate. Eric, how do you sort that out?
Well, obviously, because we were in a similar situation 4 years ago, that really kind of puts the question into focus here. The two parties are on the opposite sides of where they were 4 years ago with the Merrick Garland nomination. Of course, the timing here is an interesting one because of how, not just because it's a presidential election year, but because of how close we are to the election. Depending on how you measure it, there have been about 30 nominations that presidents have made for the Supreme Court in an election year, depending on if you want to judge it by one year previous to the date of the election and counting for 365 days, or just during the presidential election year before the election. So depending on how you want to count it, there are around 30 of those nominations. What we find when we look back historically is that a majority of those nominations, when you've had united government, where the president and the Senate majority are controlled by the same party, a majority of the time we see those types of presidential election year nominations being confirmed and the justices serving. But the percentage there drops to around half or a little less than half when you have divided government historically. If you look back, the previous closest example of a nomination to the Supreme Court during a presidential election year was a nomination made by President Millard Fillmore in August of 1852, where he nominated Edward Bradford for the Supreme Court. And that nomination was tabled, and it was probably tabled in part because there was divided government between the presidency and the Senate. But there are other examples historically of nominations being made, for instance, in July of a presidential election year under united government, where we have seen the Senate move forward and confirm nominees.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Chris now in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to raise 2 points. On the Merrick Garland issue, I think the Democrats would have no leg to stand on if Mitch McConnell would have just given them a hearing and then voted no. And the other issue I wanted to raise, I take a little bit exception to what you said previously about how judges have to wait for a case to be brought before them, because I cite the example of Justice Alito and Thomas writing that they think now is the time for the gay marriage rights to be challenged again. And they're basically just inviting someone to bring them a case, and they're even providing tips on how to argue that case.
Chris, thanks for the call. And we've talked about that on the show. The two justices, Alito and Thomas, he mentioned saying, hey, yeah, this would be a good time to revisit these things. Do justices sometimes telegraph? Again, they can't just say, we're going to do this now, but do they telegraph their interest in cases coming their way?
Most definitely. We've seen that happen historically, where either in a concurring opinion or a dissenting opinion, a justice may send a signal that, you know, if a particular issue were brought to the court, you know, they might be interested in considering that. And so I would agree with the caller 100% in the sense that sometimes we do see the justices sending those signals, and they can do that in a variety of ways. It may be in their opinions on the court. It could be in other writings that they publish. Could be during the questions they ask, even during oral argument. If you're paying close enough attention, you can kind of gauge what the justices are signaling that they might be interested in hearing. So certainly that does go on. But I mean, the point also stands that someone still needs to bring that to the court. And so again, there judges and even justices on the Supreme Court are in a role that is different from legislators, for instance, or the heads of an executive branch at the state or the federal level.
Time for one more caller. Heather is with us in Appleton. Heather, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering how the effect of the nuclear option in eliminating the two-thirds majority vote, in addition to getting rid of the filibuster, has decreased the rights of the minority to have a say in conversations like who should be the next Supreme Court justice.
Interesting question, Heather. Thanks for that. And we saw Democrats take away that filibuster for certain court appointments, Republicans then for Supreme Court justices. Does that take some of the negotiation, the minority participation out of the process, Eric?
Yeah, that was one of the concerns raised when the filibuster was eliminated for Supreme Court nominations in 2017 during the confirmation that ultimately we had the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch. It had been used a few times previously, and cloture had to be invoked. It was only actually used once successfully in a nomination for the Supreme Court to derail that nomination, which was in actually in a presidential election year in 1968, when President Johnson nominated Abe Fortas from associate justice to make him chief justice. And that was successfully filibustered, and it killed the nomination. I mean, the idea behind this is that if you don't have that need for kind of crossover appeal between the two parties, then it might ultimately change the types of nominees who are put forth by presidents, that they might be even more ideologically driven than what we've seen in the past. And so there's some concern there that that's not necessarily going to change how someone on the Supreme Court sees their role, but it might change who the president chooses to be a nominee for the Supreme Court.
And briefly, as we wrap up, thanks for that call, Heather. Briefly, one big case we know is coming up a few days after Election Day, the Affordable Care Act. This is would be, if she's confirmed, one of Amy Coney Barrett's first cases she hears.
That's correct. And you have this question here in terms of the what's called the severability of the Affordable Care Act because of the provision that is has been taken out by Congress, the individual mandate. Can the rest of the law stand on its own, including the protection for pre-existing conditions and the lifting of lifetime caps and these sorts of questions? So that will be squarely in front of the court in November. We don't expect that there'll be a decision from the court until sometime in the spring or maybe by the early summer of next year. But they are scheduled to hear that case a week after the election.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eric T. Casper is professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He joins us today to talk about the latest with the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett.